Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really, really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Dixie Fremont Smith-Kosky. She is the author of Unthinkable, Tips for Surviving a Child's Traumatic Brain Injury. This book is geared towards parents, caregivers, friends, and healthcare professionals. Stay tuned because we're going to be talking to Dixie about her personal experience from that moment she got that dreaded phone call that her son has been in an accident to raising awareness of traumatic brain injury. But first, I'd like you to know a little about Dixie. Dixie Fremont Smith-Kosky is passionate about being a mother, writer, fundraiser, public speaker, and advocate for the disabled. Not just the mother of 8 children, she is also the mother of a child who suffered a severe traumatic brain injury. Dixie helps raise awareness and funds for traumatic brain injury through working with both national and local organizations, as well as through many charity events that help benefit children. Dixie has become a writer of caregiving articles, both on the web and in health and medical-related magazines, such as the Health Monitor. Dixie shares precious tips for other parents who face a traumatic injury or illness. She also provides caregivers support, resources, and advice. She recently contributed 5 tips on stress and caregiving to empowered patients on CNN. Dixie and her son Paul are engaging motivational speakers, sharing their inspiring story to give comfort and hope to other families facing serious illness or injury. Their story has been featured on the Saturday Evening Post, and the two have made numerous appearances on TV and radio. Hi, Dixie.
Hi, Irene.
Wow. So I'm just sitting here in goosebumps and thinking, wow, you got that phone call that every parent just does not want to get. And here you are, you get that phone call, and you're told that your son has been hit by a car and while he was riding his bike without a helmet. What was that moment like for you?
The moment was actually surreal because I had just seen my son playing out in the backyard, and then about 3 minutes later I get this horrific phone call with my neighbor screaming for me to come to the end of the road that Paul had been hit by a car. So at first I just didn't believe it. I was like, no, I just saw Paul in the backyard. And then I couldn't move. I all of a sudden felt like there was something really wrong, and I just wanted to run down to the end of the street and to see if he was okay, but I couldn't move. When you hear the words that your son has been hurt or hit by a car or involved in an accident or something, there's just absolutely no way that a parent can prepare themselves for that horrific phone call, because there's just so many thoughts and emotions that surface and you just don't have any time to deal with them. And, you know, to be honest, you never think it's going to happen to you. When I did go down to the end of the street, I did find Paul laying there on his back, and he was not moving. He was unconscious, and there was blood seeping from his mouth and his head, and I didn't know if he really was breathing or if he was alive. It's a surreal and out-of-body experience seeing my child there laying helpless and me not knowing how to help him. And it seemed like forever before the ambulance arrived.
How old was he at that time?
Paul was 13.
13.
And unfortunately, he was not wearing a bike helmet. He had just gotten on his bike and going down to his friend's house, which literally lived 2 minutes from our home. And he didn't think he needed a bike helmet. And, we know different now that it could have changed the course of his life had he put it on.
Do you relive that phone call and seeing him there over and over in your mind?
Well, unfortunately, we still live in the same area, and I have to pass that intersection multiple times daily. And, yes, I do relive it. And even today, years later, when I hear the sound of an ambulance, I get chills and tears can form. It doesn't go away.
How many years ago was this, Dixie?
It happened about 5 days before the Twin Towers collapsed.
Uh-huh.
So it was September 2011, and about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh. And... So, okay, I can just imagine the ambulance was probably there in reality in a very short time. But for you, those moments must have been like you say, it's just eternity. They weren't coming long enough. And so the ambulance arrived and the technicians were there. What were you doing at that time? And what was your feeling? What were you thinking? Or do you even remember?
No, I do remember. I remember everybody's faces were just in shock, and there was just complete silence. People didn't know what to say or how to react, and I didn't know what to do either. I mean, I knelt down by my son, but people were saying, don't touch him, you know, don't move him, because we didn't know what his injuries were. Thankfully, the first person on the scene was a woman who was a respiratory nurse, of all things, and she knew how to hold him and to keep his airway open so that air was going through his, you know, his trachea or whatever, mm-hmm, whatever mm-hmm. that's called. But at the time, I wanted to be the one there holding him and not her. But in retrospect, she probably saved his life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the ambulance then airlifted Paul, from what I understand, to the medical trauma center. And, of course, he was immediately put into ICU. Did they allow you to go in with him into the helicopter and then into the ICU?
It was really, the ambulance brought him initially to a hospital that was about 5 minutes from my home, and they realized the extensive injuries that he had. So they called in the helicopter to bring him to a trauma center, which was about a half an hour away from our home, but they could airlift him there in about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I pleaded for the nurse for me to be able to go on the helicopter with them. I was just so afraid he was going to die and I wouldn't be there. And they said no, and I kept pleading and pleading, but I kept my cool because I knew if I was hysterical, they obviously wouldn't let me on.
Yeah.
The woman doctor eventually did let me on the helicopter, but I was petrified because Paul was in the back of the helicopter and I couldn't see him, so I didn't know what to expect when we landed and if, you know, he was dead or not. So we just ran, you know, through the blades of the noise of this helicopter and ran into the ICU, which in itself was scary. The lighting is just incredible, and everybody's moving really quickly and fast. And I've never been, you know, had to deal with a situation like that. It was definitely traumatic.
I can well imagine, and like you say, you know, the movement is so fast, and you're sort of in a place of the shock still, and movement is not fast for you, you know, in your reality, but you're watching all this movement. It must have been very confusing at some point, too.
Well, it's very confusing because all the medical equipment and the noises of the machines and then people talking all this terminology, medical terminology, that you have no idea how to comprehend it. So it's very foreign, it's very scary, and it's the unthinkable. You just can't imagine until you're actually there and dealing with it.
So now, do you have other children?
Yes. My husband and I are the parents of 8 children, and so very scary. At the time, my other kids were actually home. My husband was at work. My kids did hear me, you know, scream out this scream when I heard that he had been hit by a car, so they were all wondering what was going on, and then I suddenly run out the door. So I kind of left my kids in a very traumatic situation, not knowing what was going on with their brother. And then my husband and I were at the ICU for 6 days literally before either one of us came home, because the doctors had told us that, you know, Paul could possibly die within, you know, that first day, and or they weren't sure if he'd survive the next couple of days. So we didn't even come home. So my kids were, other kids were taken care of by my other family members. But it was, it changed their lives dramatically as well.
I can well imagine. I'm just thinking here as a mom, it must have been very torn, because you want to be with this child that possibly could die, but yet you have other children at home, and you know, you need to be a mom there too. And so it would just be, I'm sure, very difficult to balance all that.
Well, what happened was we knew that the other kids were in good care with the other kids, but yes, we wanted to be there for them to help them, you know, through their grief and sorrow. But what jolted us was 9/11, seeing the, you know, the planes crashing into the buildings and realizing we were dealing with our own personal trauma, but now there was this world catastrophe that my other kids had to deal with, you know, on their own, and we weren't there. So that was the day that I actually left the ICU and left Paul and my husband there.
Uh-huh.
And I knew my husband would be taking care of Paul, but I came home to take care of the other kids with this new, you know, world catastrophe as well as Paul. And it was surreal. Most people think about 9/11 as just 9/11, but I think of it as, you know, the day I came home from the ICU when my own son was dealing with a catastrophic situation.
You know, it's even hard to imagine what it would be like for you. You know, I'm listening to you, and then I'm thinking, wow, and I keep getting goosebumps as you're talking. But it's just, it's hard for me to even know what your feelings were and the confusion and, you know, just the chaos that was going on at that time.
Well, it was chaos, and you're just dealing with life and death, and unless you've ever dealt with it, you don't know what it feels like, and it's...
Well, and it's different every time, too, because the situation is always different.
The situation is always different.
Yeah.
And then you're dealing with everybody else's emotions on top of your own, which is hard. You know,
exactly. And as a parent, then you have to deal with these children, too, that are wanting to know what's happening with their brother, and is he going to live, is he going to die, and, you know, all this other drama that's going on with 9/11. My goodness. That's,
well,
high.
That's a problem.
High intensity.
It is high intensity, but as time went on, we did get some resources from the hospitals and counselors there, and they were able to offer, you know, them some counseling and informal ways for them to share their thoughts and fears. So there were some outlets that, you know, eventually they were able to cope.
Good.
But they were also suffering and, you know, going into their own depressions and coping in their own ways.
Of course.
Or not coping.
Of course. Exactly, or not coping and just maybe, you know, blocking everything so that they can live because, I mean, that's traumatic.
Well, the kids were at such different ages. At the time, my youngest was 6. My oldest was 16. So the 16-year-old would deal with it differently than, you know, a 6-year-old.
Exactly.
Many different stages of grief and that sort of thing.
So how long was Paul in ICU?
He was in the ICU in a coma for about 3 weeks.
In a coma?
He was in a coma.
Wow.
And believe me, it's not like the movies that you see when people awake from a coma where they just pop up their head
right.
And they say, hi, I'm awake. It's
Hollywood.
It's painstakingly hard to watch somebody. I mean, you're constantly doing meds and changing and checking for monitors all the while you don't know if they're going to wake up. And our fear was, you know, if Paul did wake up from the coma, you know, what would his disabilities be? You know, would he be permanently handicapped, or, you know, what would he have, loss of eyesight, or could he be able to walk, or would he cognitively would be able to think? So we were in fear. We wanted him to wake up, but we were also in fear as to what would happen when he did.
So when he woke up that first time, were you in the room?
No, I was actually at home, exhausted.
I'm sure.
My husband and I tag-teamed each other. What happened was I would stay home with the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
My husband would stay with Paul, and then we would switch. I would go and be with Paul, and then my husband would come home and be with the other kids so that there was some sort of normalcy at home.
Mm-hmm.
And but my husband was the one... there, Paul had moved his hand just slightly, squeezed his finger. And my husband had called me on the phone, ecstatic, and just said, Dixie, he's moving, he's moving. And I didn't believe it at first because my husband was very optimistic and very hopeful through the, you know, the first few weeks. And I was very distraught and more negative, like, oh, my God, he's never going to survive. So it was my husband that was there. And then I rushed in the next day and... his eyes were open, but he was still glassy-eyed and in a catatonic state, so we didn't really know what would happen and if he could really hear us. So that was very hard.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
When he woke up, he couldn't move. He couldn't speak. And we don't think he even really knew who we were.
Wow. And so tell me about the rehab. Once he came out of coma, obviously it showed that he was going to live. But then, of course, this rehabilitation that goes on for quite some time, I would imagine.
When he was stable enough, the doctors did want to get him to a rehab hospital to see if he would be able to learn how to walk and talk and perform, you know, the basic tasks of, you know, just everyday life again. So when he went to the rehab hospital, he was non-moving, non-verbal. Cognitively, we didn't know where he was at. He went to a pediatric hospital, Franciscan's Children's Hospital, which was about an hour away from our home. So the rehab was very scary in fact that when we arrived there, there were so many sick and injured and disabled children there, and it was really foreign. And it was scary to see these kids and wondering if Paul was going to end up, you know, similar, you know, just being in a wheelchair for the rest of his life or bed-bound. But once the rehab started, he did a lot of occupational, speech, and physical therapies where they really worked all day long. You know, every half hour somebody else would be coming in and working with him. And it took months and weeks before, you know, Paul was really able to lift his finger and to utter a word. But once the therapy started working, you know, it really gave us a lot of hope.
Wow. And I know that our listeners at this point, it's like, okay, where is he at this stage now? Obviously, he's gone through a lot of rehab, and this is many years later. What's Paul's condition now?
Well, Paul was in the rehab hospital for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
He lived there, which meant my husband and I were basically living there or coming back and forth for 6 months. When he returned home, he returned in a wheelchair, and he was able to use a walker when he was strong enough. Eventually, we had to scramble and try to set up some sort of head injury program at our local public school. We had checked in other hospitals and schools for disabled kids, but we felt it would be best for Paul in his situation to go back to the public school system, but they were unprepared to deal with a child with a head injury. So we had to set up this special program for Paul where he could be taught, you know, in short periods of time, you know, be able to use a tape recorder. He needed a personal aid. Mm-hmm. We had to set up an IEP, you know, to help him. It's different when you're teaching a traumatic brain injured children as opposed to teaching a person that's been born with a birth defect, because
right.
traumatic brain injury, you can actually hopefully, you know, see progress or progress with certain strategies and techniques. And fortunately for Paul, he got the help that he needed in that area. And eventually, he didn't need his wheelchair or his walker, and he was able to walk to the podium at his high school graduation and received his diploma.
Wow.
So he's a miracle in the making and in the progress. And today, you can see that Paul has, you know, some lingering deficits. His speech is kind of slow, and it takes him a second to, if you ask him a question, it takes him a second to respond.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul can respond, you know, intellectually and usually with some humor. And he also has a limp. He kind of walks a little off balance.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually in a special program at Lesley University right now in Boston, Massachusetts, and attempting to live the independent life, you know, in a college area. So he gives a lot of traumatic brain injury victims or patients, you know, hope that they can, you know, survive or move on with their lives or have some sort of quality of life.
Exactly. Well, it sounds like he is certainly on the right path to that quality of life. And how old is he now? He'd be, what, 23? Is that?
Paul's just turned 24.
24, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through Direct Podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Dixie Fremont Smith Coffey, author of Unthinkable, Tips for Surviving a Child's Traumatic Brain Injury. As a parent, to me, this is unthinkable, but very encouraging to talk to Dixie and pick out the diamonds. Stay tuned, because Dixie will enlighten us even more. Yeah. Now, Dixie, before all this happened, did you know anything about traumatic brain injury, also known as TBI?
No. I'd never heard of traumatic brain injury. We were totally unprepared as to the injury itself. We came to learn that brain injury is really unique on the specific circumstances or the severity of the injury and how somebody might have, you know, the immediate and or long-term care or the rehabilitation services. But I don't know. We didn't know anything about it. We didn't know that it can change the core of a person or who they are. And, you know, everybody is susceptible to traumatic brain injury. I mean, we all get into automobile cars.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Many kids play sports. You know, the contact sports. Our men and women often war, you know, with the blasts and the warfare. It's there, but until you know somebody, maybe you just aren't really aware of it. But it is the leading cause of death in kids under 25 now.
I had heard that, and that's really an interesting statistic. And it wasn't that long ago there was something on TV too. I had seen that where football, there are a lot of the brain injuries that happen during playing football, even though the player has a helmet on, they get BTI.
Yeah, it's everywhere in the sports world, especially within football and
mm-hmm.
hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the last couple of years, there has been a lot of more awareness and attention towards traumatic brain injury in those areas. And they are changing a lot of laws now and looking at helmets and how they're made and what they can do to protect people's brains better in those sports.
You know, our son played hockey, and he was with a helmet, but he got hitched and somehow ended up against the boards. And his helmet came off, and his face came down the board. And so that was very interesting, because this helmet was supposed to protect him, and he also had the eye protection and the mouth protection. It was a full helmet. And yet, even though it was fastened, the way he hit the boards, it came off his head.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it probably saved his life, though, if he hadn't been wearing one. I mean,
exactly.
It could have been really, really bad. But one thing that's come with the sports now is that there is more awareness. And, back in the day, you know, if a kid came off the field, you know, with a concussion or something, the coaches would say, you know, get back in there.
Right.
But now they have some other rules where they're trying to be more conscious and aware of traumatic brain injury and trying to help, you know, with these injuries, not to be so severe.
Exactly. So I imagine now your view of helmets has just increased by thousands of percent.
Yes. My son and I now do a lot of speaking engagements and trying to bring awareness to people to wear helmets, because we know now that had Paul been wearing his bicycle helmet, his injuries might not have been as
mm-hmm.
severe. So we try to, Paul actually, kind of the peer-to-peer thing, they listen more to Paul than they do to me. You know, when Paul says, it's not wicked cool to wear a helmet, but you don't want to get this messed up, you know. So the kids listen to him.
Well, that's
great. Yeah, it means something if
mm-hmm.
you know, we can help one kid not have to go through what we went through.
Exactly.
It's all worth it.
And I'm so glad that Paul is able to go and talk to kids, because, you know, like you say, it's a peer-to-peer thing. And parents can just talk until they're blue, get your helmet on, you know, blah, 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 and that's all they hear is blah, blah, blah. But when they see somebody like Paul and listen to him and see that he still has some physical disabilities. You said that he, you know, has a limp and his speech is a little slower. They can see the results, and then he probably tells them the story of the time that he was in coma and in rehab, and that's impactful.
Yeah, I think it's a wake-up call for the kids.
Exactly.
They see Paul and say, whoa, you know, I don't want to end up, you know, with a traumatic brain injury. So maybe it might make a kid think twice.
Oh, I'm sure it will. So, Dixie, how about you? How are you doing in all this?
It's been a long journey. I mean, to be honest, the caregiving has been exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody else finds themselves in the situations, in similar situation, it's just vital to know to nurture yourself and your own marriage whenever possible. And, you know, to know it's not a weakness to ask for help. That's how I've been able to cope and move forward.
And that's so important. You just said, ask for help. So I'm wondering, as a parent, you know, you went through all this with Paul, but then, of course, at some point you had to actually be a full-time parent again with your children. Did that change your parenting styles?
At first, after the injury, I was really fearful of everything. I was fearful of getting into a car or having my kids ride bikes.
Mm.
You do become more aware. And then at some point, you move on from that, and you're just like, you know, you can't be in control of life situations and what may or may not happen. So, you know, the fear doesn't go away, I guess, but it passes or changes.
It changes, probably. I don't know if it would ever pass.
Yeah.
You know, but I can imagine it does change. Now, you said the one child was 16, so now he's 26, and... you know, away from home, I'm sure. So how many children do you still have at home?
I have two children out, well, three, with Paul being at school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that you don't see a lot of... We've seen over the years how the impact of Paul's injury has affected all the other kids. And, you know, some of it has been good and some of it's been bad. I mean, my other kids perceive life differently. I think they're more in tune to other people and maybe people with disabilities now. They know they're not invincible. They try not to take, you know, the day or everybody for granted. But they've had to deal with, you know, their own ups and downs and their depressions or, you know, the thoughts of, you know, why me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why Paul?
Mm-hmm.
Why did this happen? And there's no answers to that. Really?
No, there isn't. Did they ever at some point blame him for having this accident and changing their lives?
I don't think there was blame. The kids knew that if it was one of them, that, you know, my husband and I would be there for them as much as we were, you know,
mm-hmm.
for Paul. So, but I do think that there was, no matter how hard my husband and I tried not to be so preoccupied with Paul and his injury, we obviously were. So they did get left behind. They did not get as much as attention, you know, maybe as they needed. But I don't think they blamed Paul. I think, you know, maybe they blamed us for, you know, not paying as much attention to them.
Sure.
But they understood the reality of the situation, even though that there wasn't, you know, much we could do about it.
And, Dixie, now, this book that we're talking about is called Unthinkable, Tips for Surviving a Child's Traumatic Brain Injury. But you have written some other books as well. Tell our listening audience about those two.
Well, my first book that I wrote was also called Unthinkable, and it was my personal journey. It's called A Mother's Tragedy, Terror, and Triumph Through a Child's Traumatic Brain Injury. And it's my personal journey through Paul's traumatic brain injury, the first year of his recovery and healing process. And after each chapter, I wrote specifically to another parent or caregiver specific tools and tips on, you know, how they could help their child.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized after writing the book that it was very effective and I don't know, an incredible read, but the tips at the back could actually help another parent or caregiver more without my emotional story attached to it. So what I did is I extracted the tips and put it into this new tips book,
mm-hmm.
So that if somebody is in the midst of this, you know, devastating injury, these tips would be unbelievably helpful and help them to survive.
And I can well imagine. I know that both books have been well received. And Dixie, your website address?
It's www.dixiekoski. It's COSKIE.com.
There you go, listeners. Dixie's website address is dixiekoski.com, and do check out her book. The particular one that we're talking about today is Unthinkable, Tips for Surviving a Child's Traumatic Brain Injury, and the author again is Dixie Fremont Smith Koski. And also check out her other book. It's also titled Unthinkable, and I know that this, you know, the brain injury can be just so devastating. So devastating, and especially when it's in with your own family. And I really encourage you, listeners, to check out these books and learn a little bit more about it, whether you have somebody in your family that does have a brain injury or just for plain knowledge of what really goes on. I think that we don't even think about or realize how many brain injuries there really are. Dixie, thank you so much. I just really appreciated you being online and talking with me.
Thank you, Irene.
There you go, listeners. This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.